Who are you, first of all? Scott Guthrie.
Scott Guthrie. I run the web platform and tools team. So basically, I'm responsible for ASP.NET, IIS, Visual Studio, Web Tools, and some of our hosting products. So, yeah, it's fun. So I basically run the dev test PMT.
Since I was just looking at your bookcase, what's the best ASP.NET book?
You know, I used to actually, like, collect every one of them. Like, it was like, you know, I was thinking, like, wow, you know what, I'm 95 and can't remember what I did with my life. I could look at my bookshelf and I could see, like, these 10 ASP.NET books and feel good. And I worked, like, we just hit 200 separate books that are now out. And so I stopped collecting them because at some point it just becomes a real moving headache.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's a lot of good ones. Yeah.
And how long have you been on the ASP.NET team?
I actually started the team, started working on it November of 97. So Mark Anders, a colleague of mine, and I was just finishing up a product, and we started thinking about kind of next-generation programming model stuff. And this is before the CLR and before...
Really? So you thought about it before the notion of managed code?
Yeah. The CLR was just getting started kind of independently, and so they were also starting to think kind of very early thoughts, but there wasn't any real CLR code. And so we started kind of thinking in November of 97, and then at some point we sort of said, hey, let's just write some code. And so I kind of wrote the original ASP.NET prototype over Christmas and New Year's, 97, 98.
Well, and what was the platform? In other words, what was your programming model?
A little bit different from what we finally shipped.
Sure.
But it was, you know, basically the idea of taking this notion of a framework that we wanted to have as kind of a development paradigm instead of the traditional kind of sort of linear programming that ASP and CGI had before. And so
sure.
We had this notion of components, you know, that kind of morphed into controls, and this notion of much more of an event-driven programming model instead of kind of this sort of linear, unstructured flow. And so, originally I wrote it, and it was kind of a nice API that plugged into IIS, used a combination of kind of JavaScript, sort of a few, actually, Java class libraries that I wrote. And you know, we were able to create what was then .xsp pages. So that was the original name of the project, .xsp. And everyone was always wondering what it stood for. Stood for nothing.
Sure.
X was cool back then, so
definitely.
We threw it on the name. we had to come up with a name for it eventually. We came back in January of 98, and we were able to show people pages with declarative controls and events and, you know, get people excited, and we started the team from there.
Great. So and then you heard of the CLR, and you're like, ah.
Yeah, we spent another couple months prototyping and kind of getting a sense of what we wanted to build. I mean, we spent a lot of time kind of trying different things. We kind of became infatuated with XSLT for a few months, and became uninfatuated with it. Tried different things, and then sort of we started coding about July of 98 for real. We started and said, hey, build one comes out. And originally, we were going to write in C++, native C++, and use kind of a scripting interface for extensibility. But right around that time, we bumped into the CLR team, and at the time they were brand new. No one was building managed code, and they even had their own compiler called SMAC back then, which was the only language that was kind of supported, I think, at that time. And said, "Oh, this is kind of cool stuff." And we were all kind of framework kind of guys, and so the idea of programming in a world like the CLR was really attractive.
Sure.
And so. We were a small enough team that no one really cared, and so we took a bet on them, and the rest is history.
Definitely.
So it worked out very well.
And you're their best customer so far.
Yeah.
Definitely. Your best and brightest. Golden boys.
It's worked out well. It's been
sure.
It's been the dividends, or the payoff has been huge in the sense of the benefits that we got from the CLR. So some of it was fortuitous accident. If they'd started 2 months later, or we'd started 2 months later, or 2 months earlier, I think the reality is we might not have done it. But, you know, the planets aligned and right stuff happens.
Well, web developers around the world are now able to write real object-oriented code and have a beautiful framework for you.
Yes.
Yeah, fantastic.
Works out well, And I actually started on the IIS team way back when, in kind of 97, And then as we started ASP.NET, we basically spun off the ASP.NET team into its own kind of team. And so it was two of us, then three of us, and then four of us, and kind of grew from there. And IIS kind of went into Windows. And then about a year ago, or a year and a half ago, or about a year ago, we decided to put the two teams back together again. So a lot of people just assume, oh, you must have been working on the same team for 8 years. And I go, well, actually, first year and the eighth year I have been, but 6 or 7 years in between I wasn't. But yeah, but it's been great. It's been great having you back. So now we're working heads down on IIS 7, which will ship as part of Longhorn. And that's a major, major, major release of the web server. And we're doing a lot of interesting ASP.NET and IIS unification. I think customers are going to be very, very happy with it.
Are you allowed to give us any demos yet?
I could give some demos. I got to go to another machine to do it, but we could scrounge up some demos. It'd be definitely a good Channel 9 full interview on IIS 7. You know, some of the big things that are happening, which are pretty cool, are we're moving to a web.config-based configuration model. So ASP.NET has always had an XML-based distributed configuration system where you can store configuration in XML files that live in the content directory of your application. And so it gives you much easier deployment, and it's a much cleaner model because you can modify it with a tool, you can modify it with a text editor, you can modify it with an API. And it importantly, it enables this thing we call delegation, which means that you, either as an app developer or as a site owner, can configure your own site. You don't need to be a machine owner in order to do so. And one of the challenges with IIS has been the fact that historically its configuration is stored in what's called a metabase, which is kind of an isolated configuration store that only machine admins have access to. And it's a fairly nasty schema, so it's not terribly pretty to look at. And typically what ends up happening is when you deploy an app, if you have to change an IIS setting, you have to write a command line script, log in as an administrator, run it in order to set it. And so one of the things that we're doing in IIS 7 is moving IIS 7 configuration into the same configuration model that ASP.NET uses. And so now you can actually copy any IIS configuration for that site with the site content itself in the same web.config file. Indigo settings will also be stored in that same configuration system. So it's a completely unified model, and it means that also that site owners and app owners can basically provide their own configuration data and control it without having to be logged in as an admin. So if you're in a hosted environment, it becomes just a dream in order to manage. And the benefit is if you want to make a change, open the text file, update the XML, hit save, and it takes effect. So it doesn't require a script, doesn't require an admin privilege, etc. So
and, of course, it's just process. And in other words, it's not system-wide.
Yeah, basically the way it works.
Same security model in the sense.
Yeah, it's the same security model as ASP.NET in the sense that it's hierarchical. So you can set something at the root level, which applies to all apps on the box. Or you can set it at a site level and apply only to one site. Or you can set it at an app level and set it only to one app. Or you can set it at a directory level and set it only to that directory. And so anything you set above will automatically inherit. You can override things. You can lock down things. You know, it's very flexible from that perspective. And the key thing is, as a box owner, you can say, hey, there's certain settings like security I'm not going to let you change. But if you want to change what your default document is, or if you want to change whether directory listings allowed or denied in this directory, or what the default cache policy is on this page, you know, that isn't something that you should have to be an admin on the box to do. I'm going to delegate those to you, and now you can easily do it. You can FTP the content around with the configuration and the code. Everything works.
Great.
So it should be, you know, that's a huge win. And then the other big thing that we're doing, or one of the other big things we're doing with IIS 7 is componentizing it. So the idea with componentization is instead of having kind of one server, which is one giant binary with a lot of stuff kind of built in with assumptions, is breaking apart the web server into about 40 or 50 different modules.
Excellent.
And have the module API be totally public. There's both a native and a managed version. And the managed API is the same one that, if you know ASP.NET, the IHP module interface. So if you have an existing module, you know how to build new ones. It's the same type. And you can basically now choose what components in your web server you want to have installed or not. So you can reduce your attack surface. But the real neat thing is from a developer perspective, you can now build modules that plug in and extend the server in any way you want.
Wow.
So if you want to add a new authentication type or a new authorization system, or if you want a new custom error handling mechanism or a new compression system or new whatever, You can now build a module, plug it in. You can replace any of the existing IIS functionality that way, and really have total control of the system.
You can replace it.
Yeah. Right.
You can override existing functionality.
So if you wanted, for example, if you collect pictures, or not collect pictures, but if you do digital photography, you might have, in the past said, I'm going to build a page that, lists all my pictures and has, the EXIF information around them. And one of the cool demos that someone on my team's built is they built a directory listing module so that all you need to do is actually just copy the images into a directory. And when you go to that directory, instead of getting the standard IIS list of just the file names, it'll actually do a thumbnail gallery and pull out all the EXIF information. Without you having to write any code, without you having to configure anything, it just does it. And then all it's done is basically uninstalled the built-in directory listing and plug in the zone for that portion of the website. And away you go. So you start to see some pretty interesting stuff you can do there.
Now, what about performance when you say componentization and more abstract thinking like that?
Well, one nice thing about the modularization is that once you partition any product, whether it's Office, Visual Studio, or a web server, into more pieces, it often becomes a lot easier to be able to identify bottlenecks in the overall system. Because from a profile perspective, we can run a profile now. We can know, this module is taking 12% of the time.
Right.
Whereas before it was, this function or, some code inside this module that had, thousands and thousands of, components or subsystems. Or not thousands, but maybe let's say dozens of subsystems. And so one nice thing also is we can bypass modules. And so you can trigger some modules to just opt out. So, for example, if you're using Windows authentication, there's no need to have the four other authentication types that we currently have in IIS. And so we can just say, the authentication mode that's used is currently this one. Just don't have these modules execute on requests and just opt out. And so that gives you big performance wins because we can now, tune the system dynamically a lot more efficiently than before. So, we think, at the end of the day, it'll be a faster web server than IIS6, which is today pretty darn fast.
Pretty, very fast.
So, it's going to be a very exciting product. Yeah.
Excellent.
What about web? Do you run the web standards here at Microsoft? Or
I don't. No, we have some teams that are engaged on, say, the HTTP spec.
Okay.
But I'm not involved in the HTML or I'm not on the HTML standards. No.
Right.
So we work with all browsers.
Okay.
So one of the things that we are doing with WIDB, with ASP.NET 2.0 with WIDB, is we are doing a lot of work to be standards compliant. So we're not on the standards bodies, but a couple of things that we're doing is all of our controls by default are now emitting XHTML compliant markup. Which
Do you
is,
hear that, everybody out there?
Yeah.
Well, people are, this is the longest threads in the world on Channel 9 are about just this.
XHTML compliant,
so the ASP.NET team does it again.
Yep. All of our controls will be XHTML compliant by default. There's a certain set of folks that say, I don't want to be XHTML compliant. There is a use deprecated markup config switch you can turn on, which will cause you to go back to
HTML 401 or something.
Yeah, HTML 401. There are a few weird things in XHTML that are just a pain. That'll cause you to go back. But by default, the XHTML compliant. We'll also be Section 508 compliant for accessibility.
Great.
So if you're seeing impaired, and we're also doing the work to be WCAG compliant, which is the W3C accessibility guidelines, I think. It's been interesting that if you actually look at those three standards, there are portions of each standard which are mutually exclusive, so you can't be XHTML compliant and be completely accessible compliant. So it is kind of, you do have to sometimes choose your standards, and there's always weird edge cases, but we're doing all the work so that all of our infrastructure is compliant with all those three, and you can build an app that is fully standards compliant, and more importantly, it'll be the default.
And this is in WIDB.
This is in WIDB. The other thing we're doing in WIDB from the Visual Studio side is making sure that when you're in source mode or when you're in your design view in the web designer, we'll generate XHTML compliant markup by default. And when you go into source mode, there's a richer schema model so that you can actually choose what schema you want to target. So it can be HTML 401, it can be XHTML strict, it can be XHTML transitional, it could be Firefox, it could be IE.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll actually modify our IntelliSense so that both from a tag perspective as well as importantly from a client side script perspective, will actually filter automatically to only show you those properties of that object model that's available for the schema you're targeting, which is kind of cool.
That's great.
And so we'll do that both for standards as well as different browser device stuff.
Now, when I do, for example, inline CSS, are you going to leave my formatting alone?
Yes. So you do inline CSS.
Thank you.
We do not touch your markup. We'll also then, just as to make up for it, we'll provide IntelliSense now for inline CSS, as well as for pretty much every markup type in the file. And we'll even, depending on what standard you pick, we'll actually automatically, in IntelliSense, filter out so that only those CSS attributes for that device that are supported show up. So if you say, oh, I want to do HTML 3.0 or 4.01, versus IE6, when you go to style equals, we'll actually only show you those attributes that are 401 compliant, whereas if you do IE6, there's a few extra ones, and you can basically filter based on that. And you can create your own custom schemas as well. So if you want to create your own standard, the Scoble standard, you create it, copy the XML file in the system, we'll give you a full IntelliSense and validation against it.
Now, let's talk about a few scenarios that are evolving, right? Wikis is one. Mm-hmm. Do you guys do anything to enable turning on a wiki functionality at all? Or?
Yeah, there's a couple wiki ASP.NET apps that are out there.
Okay.
We're doing a couple things on my team in terms of going after kind of what we think of as sort of the common internet applications. And so there's a free offering we're going to come out with, start beta testing with a number of key hosting providers in the next month, and then you can also just download it for your own server if you want to.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll provide a blog based on .txt, a photo album system based on InGallery, a forum system based on the popular forum system, HTML forum system, kind of content management system based on .nuke.
This is going to all be in out of the box.
You'll be able to actually run this even on V1.1. So one of the things that we did is we actually have taken some of the features in ASP.NET 2.0, like the membership system, the role management system, the personalization system, and we backported them onto V1.1 of ASP.NET. And so we've actually been working with the community server folks that own .txt and Gallery and the forums, as well as .NET Nuke. And basically what they've done is their latest versions will actually write to that backported membership, role management, personalization system.
Great.
Which means that they're now integrated. They'll be even more integrated. So when 2.0 comes around, they port on top of that. It'll just work. And so you'll be able to reuse your same username, password schemas and things like that. But more importantly, they work together. So you can now build a site and say, oh, I want to have, I want to build a community site, and I want to have a photo album, I want to have a blog, and I want to have a forum discussion system. You'll be able to install it for free and be good to go. And all the source is there, so if you want to customize it, tweak it some more, you're obviously you can. But,
And you'll have to take care of the back-end SQL database.
We're doing special stuff to make sure that from a hosting perspective, you'll be able to get that solution I'm talking about for, $6-7 a month. It's kind of, I think, where we'll be, maybe 6 months from now.
Okay.
So it'll be very affordable. That's unique domain name, that's email, that's a whole bunch of stuff. But make it very, very affordable.
Hosted where?
Pretty much we're going to work with every hosting provider out there, anyone that wants to work with us. So
right.
We're working now with some of the biggest ones in order to, we'll do a pilot phase and so you'll start to see them showing up. But any hoster that wants to, it's available for them for free. And, it's one of the things I think it is going to do is dramatically increase the number of just personal sites that you want to go ahead and build.
How about, with Weblog, of course, you're going to get an RSS feed. But
yep.
In the marketing world, we were talking about this, that more and more even homepages are going to expect to have RSS
mm-hmm.
feeds. So is the server going to do something for you, or you still have to build a...
Well, the nice thing with those apps I was talking about that we're putting together, they will all have RSS feeds.
Okay.
So the forum system, the photo album, the blog, they'll all have RSS feeds that you can subscribe to. So you can say, subscribe to this forum thread. And every time a message shows up, it'll show up in your RSS feed. Or
this will be doing on Channel 9.
Yep. Yeah.
Let me use their source code.
But you want RSS to find an old style front page site. You have to actually rebuild it in one of the newer tools.
You have to rebuild it per se. I mean, you'll be able to download these sets of apps, use front page in order to edit them, and you're good to go, and you'll get RSS. The challenge, I think, at least I haven't seen any easy way you can just automatically RSS a site. Mainly because, I mean, you could. You just say, oh, every bit of text, go ahead and put it in the RSS channel. But I think reality is you probably want to have a little bit more structure and a little bit more semblance. Otherwise, it's just information overload.
Right.
And so certainly, some of the things that we're doing in WIDBI in terms of, like some of our XML features, it's pretty simple to build a blog reader now with WIDBI. I think you can do it. I think I've got it so you can do it with no code. Yeah, I can do it. Yeah, I can build a blog reader with no code and ASP.NET with me.
Okay.
It's kind of funny. I'm sure you can build better ones with a little bit of code, but it'd be a lot easier to do those types of features.
So let's talk a little bit about the development model and architectural changes in 2.0. I know there are some.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the most dramatic changes? You can use perhaps some of the best word, but I know, for example, have there been changes in code behind that model?
Yeah, that's a good question. From an architectural perspective, there's an awful lot of new features in WIDBI for ASP.NET. In terms of the code size, like if you just look at system.web.dll alone, the size of it, I think, is doubled or tripled, which gives you an indication of how many new features are actually out there. So there's a lot of new features.
How much time you guys spent in security reviews?
We just finished a little over 8,000 code reviews for the security push. We finished the last one Wednesday of last week. Each of those security reviews, I think on the average is, those 8,000 is between 30 minutes and 3 hours. So it gives you a sense of how much time we spent. At some point, your mind starts to go to mush. So you have to actually schedule so that after about 4 hours, you say, hey, that's enough for today, just because you start to go cross-eyed. But, there's a lot of stuff we've done in security review to make sure it's totally secure and safe out of the box. In terms of architectural things, we try not to change the model dramatically. What we try to do is basically extend the model in a lot of different ways, so that if you're familiar with, you don't have to worry about, oh my God, I have to relearn a whole bunch of stuff. It's more a case of, oh, I don't need to write all that code anymore. I can go ahead and this is built in for free. So, for example, most sites have built some kind of security architecture with role management, maybe a username password system for keeping track of things. You can now use the built-in role management and membership system that's just built into WIDBI to do all that for you. And you can point it at Active Directory, you can point it at a SQL database, and you can point it at your own store.
Great.
And the nice thing is, hey, that's a couple thousand lines of code that you probably had to write today. There's some perf things that you probably want to do with caching, with roles that are a little bit tricky. All that stuff's done for you. And the benefit is you can just add it to your existing apps. You don't need to rewrite them completely. It's pretty easy to add. For personalization, I want to keep track of, what are the last 10 blogs I read, or what are the last, what's my favorite, what location am I in right now, et cetera. Those types of things, if you want to store them on a site for a per-user basis, today you can write a bunch of data code and do it for you, or do it yourself. With WIDBI, there's a new profile store, so you can just say, oh, here are the attributes about a user visiting my site that I want to be able to keep track of. Now I have a profile object. I just say profile dot, zip code equals, type it in. All the storage and retrieval of it is done for you. Again, just saves you a bunch of code. Same things for navigation, and a whole bunch of other sort of scenarios. We then built a whole bunch of what we call page framework features, which is probably the biggest architectural changes. I think the most popular one is going to be what we call master pages, which is the ability to say, hey, say take a Channel 9 site. We have, say, 30 or 40 pages on the site. we all want to have, we want to make sure we have a consistent layout. So, you know, there's a navigation system on the left, and there's a title bar with the Channel 9 logo, and there's a footer that has the copyright, all that stuff. You know, today, the way you probably enforce that is you have to build separate controls for them or have include files or just duplicate the content. And the challenge with all those is if you want to change the look and feel, you got to go back and touch everything. And with Wibby, we have this notion we call master pages, so you can define a template once, which defines kind of the overall look and feel of the site and then has replaceable regions. And then you can just say, oh, I want to build a new page based on this template, and I'm just going to fill in these two or three regions. And now if you ever want to change the overall look and feel, change it one place, it's saved, the whole site takes effect.
Visual inheritance, exactly.
And we even have it in Visual Studio so that you get inheritance from a UI perspective. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you open up a page based on a master, all the master contents are grayed out, so you can still see them, but you can't edit them. You can go to the master page, make a change, come back to the page, and it'll just take effect. And you can just edit in that page that's based on the master, the editable region. So it's that, I think, is a feature that we've heard from customers. They just go gaga over. You know, that's used all over the, that'll be used in every site. Likewise, we're doing some interesting things with themes and skinning to make it easier to kind of componentize style information and apply it in a consistent way across the site.
Right.
I think that'll be big. We've incorporated web parts, so if you're familiar with SharePoint, there's this notion of what's called a web part, which allows you to do kind of personalization, drag and drop UI and lay things out. That's now all built into Wibby, and the next version of SharePoint will be based on top of that infrastructure. So the nice thing is, if you want to build a Yahoo-style like portal, you know, you can probably do it in a day or two in terms of information. The operation side is much harder, but from a programming model perspective, providing that kind of drag and drop UI, providing a consistent UI, doing it in a secure way with membership and roles, you know, having common navigation metaphors, things like menus that are driven off of either a CMS system or an XML layout file for navigation, all that's built in.
One thing I've always wanted with SharePoint is a ability to hook it together with other SharePoint systems so that we could have like a main ping page,
mm-hmm.
or some way of notifying other servers, hey, this just got updated, so that I can have a master display of sites that just got updated.
One of the things that we have in
And also so I can hook them together for search engines, right, spiders and stuff.
Yeah.
Like
well, one of the things that we have in terms of sort of the caching thing you're kind of talking about, like the notification of changes, is one of the big features we also have in Wibby is this thing we call SQL cache invalidation, which is specific to databases. And basically what that means is you can now say, output cache this region of a page. So if you want to have, like, say, a SharePoint site with an aggregate view of multiple sites, and then anytime the database changes, regenerate it. And one of the things that we've done, though, is that's specifically with databases, which is a really common scenario for, you know, most web apps. But you can also, it's genericized, so that you can go ahead and build your own invalidation provider. And so you could, you know, it's not built in, but you could absolutely have some mechanism so that when a site changes, it invalidates another site, and it just causes it to regenerate those settings on the site that are based on the other ones. Yeah, definitely.
Right. How would you plug into that site's model? In other words, some sort of, I imagine in SQL you're getting SQL events.
Yep.
How would you do it for a different site?
Well, one way you could do it, I mean, you just need to do an RSS invalidation feed. And so you could actually say, you know, use the RSS, see whether or not something's changed in the RSS feed as to whether or not you want to trigger an invalidation.
So polling.
You could do it polling. I mean, what we do with SQL is for SQL 2000, we do polling. For UConn, we actually do a push notification. And so you could, likewise, polling is nice because you don't have to have the other site participate in your model. Push would be even better. Certainly the model could support it. You could have the site push you a notification.
Sure.
Yeah. Are you testing with Firefox and other browsers?
Yep.
I'm sure
yep.
that'll be a big yep. question since a lot
yep.
of...
Yep, we did. We use Firefox a lot. And that is something that we've been testing quite a bit. So if people download the beta and you find a bug with Firefox, do let us know. Because that is definitely something that we're trying to make sure.
There's other browsers too, Opera and Safari.
Opera and Safari. We test with Safari. I think we test with Opera as well.
Okay. What about for cell phones, for mobile devices?
Yep. For mobile devices, we support the mobile controls on ASP.NET, which shipped in V1.1 and they continue to ship in V2. And we've done some integration in terms of integrating like security models and things like that. But you can build an ASPX page that uses the mobile controls and target. The mobile controls can automatically target WAP as well as XHTML basic or mobile, as well as HTML for things like PDAs. And so you can, and it has a model for doing things like.
Are you testing your templates with mobile phones? Because one thing I've noticed with web pages, now that I have a nice phone that displays
the
web,
audio box,
yeah, the audio box,
too,
and a lot of people put navigation on top of, you know, in their HTML, they'll put the navigation code on top of the content code, which is really not what you want to see. You want to see the content code first on your phone. So
we don't automatically rearrange your page for you that way. But one of the things you can do is you can easily build a mobile page specific to cell phones or to any form factor and specifically assume it has smaller real estate. And you can use our controls, and our controls are adaptive. So, you know, if it's a 10-line cell phone, it'll actually show a different menu from a PDA device that's larger. What you typically would do is say, hey, there's a Channel 9 homepage and then a Channel 9 mobile page.
Okay.
And then when a request comes in, just see whether or not which request it is, and you can automatically on the server redirect it based on the device type.
Interesting.
So you'd still end up writing a special mobile page. But, you know, building it, if you have a database and a component that, you know, gets the Channel 9 data, you know, building a mobile page, you know, you should be able to do it in an hour or two.
Yeah. But the web designer still has to use...
You still have to think a little bit about it.
I mean, if you're using if you have somebody doing a front page site and they don't really think about that, you're not going to be able to automatically fix it on the server side.
It's kind of hard. I mean, one of our original goals with ASP.NET 2.0 was much richer mobile support and have all ASP.NET controls be mobile aware. And so we do have, from an architecture perspective, this thing we call an adapter architecture that is built into WIDBI. Because of time pressure, mainly, we pulled the mobile automatic mobile adapters from the ASP.NET controls, and we'll probably ship them in the next release, or maybe even a download after WIDBI ships. But even then, it's not automatic in the sense of, you know, especially if you have a tiny cell phone, if you have a page that's optimized for a 19-inch screen, it's really almost impossible to get it to be optimized for a 7-line WAP phone. You know, at least with a mobile browser like the audio box, it's a little closer because it's Pocket IE. But even then, you know, you need to be able to annotate it in a way that's going to get you the right important information and the limited real estate you have. And so, but we will get to a point where at least the programming model is the same. So from a designer or developer perspective, once you learn how to build a page, you know how to target mobile devices and vice versa.
Right,
which is a big step forward.
And as you mentioned, it's the content that's interesting, especially for devices as small as the ones you have.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't really make sense to surf the web on an audio box for visual reasons. I mean, you just want to get information, so you subscribe to RSS, which I'm sure you do.
Oh yeah.
And you just read text.
Yep.
So
that's one way around it. My web page has just been designed from, you know, content goes first to navigation at the bottom. And, you know, that just takes some education on the web designer's point of view.